Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. I'm pleased to welcome the audience here live in San Francisco and also our radio and online audiences. And I would like to introduce Henry Eason, who is a managing partner of Eason Communications. And in his previous life, he was a Washington correspondent for Cox Newspapers, was right at the heart of the Washington life, if we can call it that, for 15, 20 years. And then he was a director of media relations for the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, also part of the Washington life. So he is going to be speaking tonight about the night after the Machiavellian marketplace and the 2012 election. Thank you very much. Henry?
Well, first I'd like to say that I didn't choose this topic. George is a sort of a semi-graduate school professor who assigns difficult topics to people and then asks them to try to figure out how to explain it. But it just so happens that in this case, I really liked the topic, and I really did a little bit of fresh research, and I prepared some ideas for you. We just got done with an election, but if we can just hold off for a little while so we can explore this topic before we get into our electoral comments, I have a new perspective for you all to think about. First, I'd like to ask you to raise your hands if you would enjoy having someone call you a Machiavellian person. I see two people, three people, four people out of 40, and I assume you're all very well-read people. Because contrary to all we have heard about Niccolo Machiavelli, he was actually a wonderful individual who had incredible ideas that were used by not only Thomas Jefferson, but John Adams and most of our founding fathers, most of the Enlightenment philosophers. I assume that we're all fascinated with philosophy here because this is Monday Night Philosophy, so I don't have to explain who the Enlightenment philosophers were, and actually had an enormous influence on the development of political science. As we know it today, a lot of people like to think of Machiavelli as having been one of the original political scientists. Now, who was this guy? If you don't know much about Machiavelli, I'm going to take you quickly through his life and give you my perspective on why he is regarded so pejoratively, as often as he is, by nearly all of you in this audience, for one thing. Machiavelli was born during the time of Columbus. He was born in Florence, wealthy family. He came to his own political career at the time that the Medici family, read Tony Soprano, were kicked out of Florence. The Medicis were a very, very powerful Italian family that ran things most ruthlessly. Finally, the people of Florence got sick and tired of them. They kicked them out. They were gone. During that period of time, 8 to 10 years, Machiavelli, young political type, got a job working at a fairly high level in the new Republic of Florence because it had been kind of like a dictatorship. So Machiavelli was a civil servant at a high level. He ran the militia of Florence. He was commissioned as a diplomat to travel from Florence to France, Spain, Austria, and the Vatican, and numbers of other Italian republics and city-states. You got to remember that Machiavelli, during this period of time, the late 1400s, early 1500s, there was no Italy. It was a geographic area with literally dozens of little states, and they were always squabbling with each other, and they had all the result of 1500 years before that. They were all part of the Roman Empire. So Machiavelli was able to look at all these little warring states. He was able to look at France and Spain and Austria and their machinations throughout Europe as a political science laboratory. He had a very fresh way of looking at things. Now, he, unfortunately, was involved with the Republic at the time when Charles of France invaded Italy, brought in his train the Medici leaders, reinstall the Medici family in Florence. And the Medici family at that point decided that all the people that had been running Florence before that were really bad people, and so they arrested them, including Machiavelli, and they tortured them and killed a lot of them. Machiavelli was tortured in a very specific way. His arms were drawn up behind him, his hands were tied by ropes, and he was lifted up this way, so both of his arms and shoulders were broken, dislocated, and he hung back from his arms backwards on a rope for weeks. Apparently, people used to study the most excruciating methods of torture in those days throughout the Middle Ages because they wanted to get a lot of information out of their subjects. Where was the gold buried? Who was really for them and against them? You know, they had a lot of information they wanted to get out of Machiavelli. They realized that he wasn't going to volunteer it, so they hung him up by his arms backwards to the point where he would pass out. He would wake up, pass out, and someone would be sitting there taking down all the information. After that, they got everything they wanted out of him. They threw him out into the street. Well, his family was fairly well off, so he ended up in Exurbia in a little country estate where he began to write. Well, obviously, he missed his time as a civil servant terribly, wanted to get back in, so he wrote this love letter that's about 100 pages long called The Prince. And it was written to Lorenzo de' Medici, who was Lorenzo the Magnificent. And basically, he just gave up everything. He said, all right, you know, I don't want to be tortured anymore. Here's a poem to you telling you how everything you do to gain and use power is perfectly fine. It's rational, it's efficient, it's tough love, right? That's The Prince. Now, if we just look at The Prince or read The Prince, and then we decide that Machiavelli is the result, his ideas, Machiavellian ideas, are all about The Prince, we're going to be horribly mistaken because he wrote 30-odd other books. And the most prized book written and appreciated by historians and philosophers is called The Discourses on Livy. Livy was a Roman historian. Livy wrote all about Rome, all about the Roman Republic, all the Roman emperors. He just cataloged it. During the Renaissance, we were discovering all of these ancient texts and books. People like Poggio was bringing these texts to us. For the first time, the people who'd suffered through 1,000 years of the Dark Ages realized that, guess what, there used to be this other place called Rome, the Roman Empire, the Roman Republic, and they did things in a really interesting way back then. And there was almost like a fascination with all of the things that you could find in books by people like Livy, L-I-V-Y, if you ever want to read him. It was actually quite fresh and interesting. So Machiavelli wrote The Discourses, a much longer book, and in The Discourses he makes very strong arguments for a republican form of government versus a monarchy, a nobility monarchy, which is the primary model of government in those days, nobility monarchy, which you all know about from all the movies and things that you see. They were experimenting with republicanism, with a little r, by the way, and Machiavelli thought that was the best way to go. So he wrote, his greatest body of work is all about republicanism, and advocates for the most part that we should have a country, and I've got some quotes here that I'd like to read to you. I think that the quote from Machiavelli that I think is, I can never find my quotes when I write all these things down. Governments of the people are better than those of princes. Now that seems like a really obvious thing to us in the 21st century, but you got to remember that 99.999% of all governments in the world were run by royalty and princes. And this was so heretical that Machiavelli, his works were suppressed. The only person that got to see the prince was Lorenzo. He sent his manuscript to Lorenzo and said, here, take it, read it. I want to be your guy, you know. I wrote about how you can, I'm giving you an excuse for all the horrible things that you do to maintain power. It's okay. I just don't want to be tortured anymore. That was pretty much the reason The Prince was written. But his primary philosophy was that we should have a republic that is a result of people voting for something that they want. And not all people, of course, but in those days, landed people, people who composed the greatest majority of respectable, wise leaders, people who could read and write. This is what Machiavelli is all about. In reality, if you do a little bit of study on him, you're going to find out that you are all Machiavellians. As a matter of fact, our whole country is Machiavellian in a very good sense. Machiavelli went a little further to talk about the depths of republicanism, what was really required. And I would submit to you that, you know, looking, you know, having spent most of my life in politics in one fashion or another, and in history because my first career was in history, I would submit to you that we have a Machiavellian political marketplace in this country, which he did not perfectly describe, but which he forecast in some fashion. Now, if I can take a little flight here, I would just say that if you want to really understand American politics, and I've spent time in D.C. and in New York and all over, in fact, capitals all over the world, reporting on this topic and reading and studying on this topic, I think we're pretty fortunate to live in a country which has a political system which, and bear with me for a moment before you all rise up and start throwing things at me, mirrors Wall Street. Now, what do I mean by that? Our presidential elections are the result of a great deal of money being spent on advertising and on ground games, as we heard them described over the last few days. A billion by one candidate, a billion by another candidate, tremendous amount of money going out to create impressions and to influence opinions. And then the result is that we have a president. Now, exactly what does the money look like? Let's just for a second assume that we have, stay with me for a minute, assume that we have a political marketplace in this country. We don't yet know how much was spent in this past election. We know it was somewhere between $2 and $3 billion for the two candidates and all the people that were helping them on either side. But we do know about 08. And for purposes of this discussion, let's just take a quick look. In 08, McCain, remember John McCain, and Obama spent $1.6 billion together. Obama spent a lot more money than McCain. In fact, on a per-vote basis, Obama spent $10.94 for each vote that he got. McCain spent $5.97 for each vote that he got. So this seems like a terrible process. I mean, the influence of money in politics, what could be more horrible, right? This is just terrible. We're just drenched in all this horrible money. It's terrible. It's a joke. Frankly, we spent less than $2 billion on selecting our president, right? And the Snack Food Association of America says that the same year we elected Obama in the race with McCain, we spent $24 billion on Fritos, Cheetos, and potato chips. The same year, we spent $37 billion on pizza, $2 billion on the presidential election. So either we buy these guys really cheap, or we don't really care that much about them because we're not willing to spend very much money. 84% of the talk about participation, not money, but participation, 84% of Americans eat potato chips, but only 57% vote. So where are our values? How are we really participating in the process? Well, this is an interesting perspective that I got. See, I've gone really far away from Machiavelli, but maybe not so that far as you might think. A group of MIT political scientists did a study, and they ended up with this conclusion. Because they wanted to know why is so little money spent on electing politicians. Really, very little indeed. In fact, I don't remember the number, but it's extremely small, the amount of money that was spent electing all of the members of Congress from California. It's cheap. I mean, people spend that kind of money going to Vegas back and forth for some sort of convention. These MIT political scientists said, quote, campaign contributions are not a form of policy buying, but are rather a form of political participation and consumption. And they think it's a good thing. And I think it's a good thing. This audience that we have with us tonight may or may not agree with this. I don't know how many people could... How many people could see a show of hands made a political contribution to any candidate? That's about a third of you.
Much higher.
Raise your hands high. I would say maybe half. Maybe half of you spent some money on a candidate, but I guarantee you wasn't much as you spent on pizza. Unless I'm mistaken. So here we have spent a very little bit of money electing these people. We have a lot of passion about them, but we really don't spend that much on them to do what they're supposed to be doing, running their campaigns in clever ways. But actually, having spent so much time as I did in Washington, I can tell you that presidential campaigns and even congressional campaigns are not where the money is spent. The money is spent year in, year out, day in, day out, week in, week out, by the several thousand lobbies in Washington and by the hundreds of lobbies in Sacramento. Now, that's where things happen. That's where liberalism and conservatism don't really play much of a role. I remember I had a lot of beats when I was a reporter covering Congress, and I remember how astonishing it was to see liberal anti-war members of Congress voting quietly for massive weapon systems. And then curious, asking around, only to learn that some of those weapon systems were made in their districts. Tip O'Neill was always a most liberal Speaker of the House we've ever had, but Tip O'Neill loved warplanes because their engines were made in his district. So I can go on and cite case after case after case, but the fact of the matter is there is an enormous role of money in politics. And I work for the largest business lobby on earth, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. We raised tons of money in support of general business issues. We had about 90 issues that we worked on at any one time. Such things as free trade. We were very interested in free trade. We were very interested in it seems like it was our primary interest was in trying to create an environment where the world would trade more freely with each other. It seemed to be most of our spending. But I would say that if you want to assign a moral role to money in politics, an ethical role to money in politics, you need to think twice, because you may be discouraging the formation of an interest group that benefits you. The Sierra Club. Chris, your brother is an editor with the Sierra Club. I love the Sierra Club. My own political bias is very, very dangerous, and I hesitate to even tell you, given any audience that I'm ever in, because I'm a political centrist, so that my right-wing friends think I'm a communist, quite sure of it. My left-wing friends know that I'm a fascist, right? But I'm right dead in the middle, taking heat from both sides. And but the Sierra Club, that's why. When Obama was elected, I was crestfallen and uplifted at the same time. It's a schizophrenic state, because half of the things the Democrats want to do I love, and the other half I hate. And the same with the Republicans. So I don't know how to react to political campaigns when they occur, being a centrist. But I will tell you that I'm a centrist because I'm a Machiavellian, because I analyze things, I look at things empirically. That's what Machiavelli did. Get back to philosophy for a second. Machiavelli studied all these different Roman governments and all the governments that existed around him in Europe during the Renaissance, and he then reached conclusions after he examined all the empirical evidence that was available to him. And that's the way I was trained to do things as a reporter. Consequently, I didn't even vote until I was no longer a reporter, because I didn't feel like I could ever reach a conclusion about something. But I will say one thing. I realized rather quickly that the influence of money and politics is ever present and absolutely essential and necessary. When I was a young reporter in South Carolina covering state government in Columbia, I didn't know much about what was going on. I was right out of grad school, and a old state senator called me aside, and friendly guy, and he said, look, I'm just going to give you a little advice. When it comes to understanding what happens in the state of South Carolina, don't listen to any of the speeches. Follow the money. Follow the campaign contributions. See who is involved economically in any particular issue, and that's going to give you an understanding of what's going down. And, you know, that was back in 1974, and I've been doing that ever since, and I think it's a pretty safe way to go. How do you find out about these things? The Federal Election Commission has a website. You can go and look up a great deal of information about your congressional candidates, your presidential candidate. You can see who, to some extent, they do a really good job trying to hide the money by creating all these foundations and funds and campaign groups that sound like good government number 32, good government number 34. So it's kind of hard to penetrate. But by and by, you can actually figure out who's contributing to whom, and you can decide whether or not you like the candidate. Because believe me, they will behave according to those who give them money. Now, this is a very American thing to do. This is a good thing to do. We have been doing this since before we were America. I told you I like history, so I read recently a biography of George Washington, the greatest American ever. It's not Obama, it's George Washington. George Washington was bribed his way into the House of Burgesses in Virginia before the Revolution ever took place. He was a colonial aristocrat, and he wanted to get in the House of Burgesses, which ran Virginia. So what did he do? He went around, spread money all over the place in Fairfax County. So it's an all-American thing to do. And as far as other founding fathers are concerned, practicing the Machiavellian marketplace, you got to remember, they all read Machiavelli. In fact, John Adams was known to be a Machiavellian scholar. He not only read The Prince, but he read the Discourses. He read a great many of the other things that Machiavelli wrote. Thomas Jefferson was fluent. They made references to Machiavelli. They understood him. We can actually say, believe it or not, that Machiavelli was somewhat involved in influencing the way we created this government that we've had ever since. So why don't we look at some of our founding fathers, like, for example, James Madison said that the political society was like a sphere. Madison is probably one of my favorites to read because he was colorful. And imagine this. This is a quote. Extend the sphere. He's talking about extend the political process out. Extend the sphere and you take in a greater variety of parties and interests. You make it less probable that a majority of the whole will have a common motive to invade the rights of other citizens. See, these people really thought things through. They studied the philosophers. They studied the ancient philosophers. The marketplace influence has been helpful in Western democracies. It has had the inverse relationship in communist socialist governments in Russia, China, and so on. There's no marketplace. There's one ruler. There's no free expression of ideas. John Milton, Areopagitica, the great philosopher, the first great philosopher of freedom of the press, read Machiavelli extensively, made quite a few references to Machiavelli. Alexis de Tocqueville, all of you know or read Alexis de Tocqueville, a Frenchman who came over here in the 1830s and studied this incredible thing going on called America. You know, he's just trying to figure out what the hell's going on. It's just these people are growing, they're prospering. What are they like? It was a brand new republic. We had a republic for like 3 decades, right? He was concerned, however, with what he saw, and these words resonate even today. He said, visiting the new republic, the American republic will endure until the day Congress discovers that it can bribe the public with the public's money. Let's think about that, and let's take a look what's happening today. Continuing to Tocqueville, a democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the voters discover they can vote themselves largesse from the public treasury. From that moment on, the majority always votes for the candidates promising the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that a democracy always collapses over loose fiscal policy. 1830s. Always followed by a dictatorship. The average age of the world's greatest civilizations has been 200 years. Okay, we got this republic of ours back in the 1780s, right? So are we 30 years into decline or what? And I'll bet you guys have got questions and comments.
Thank you very much. I'd like to remind our audience that we're listening to Henry Eason speak about the 2012 election and the influence of Machiavellian thought. And now we can talk about anything. We can talk about the election or Machiavelli or just your reaction to what happened or how you feel about the influence of money on the system. So who would like to ask the first question?
Well, apparently there was a lot of money spent by some, quote, billionaires in this country to try to influence the election. And apparently they were unsuccessful. So that shows that always they can't always buy the election. But that was different than what you're talking about. That was people spending money to advertise, to influence people to vote a certain way, not what you just talked about. So can you comment on that?
Yeah, well, actually, I was talking about that, and it was on both sides. We have billionaires voting for Democrats and Republicans and influencing campaigns on both sides. And billionaires, 100 millionaires, I mean, after $100 million, you know, you're a pretty rich guy. You can spend your money however you like, or gal. I mean, there was a woman who had spent an enormous amount of money on Proposition 38, and it went down very far. And she spent a lot of her money with, I'm sure, a good heart. What do you do when you make? I mean, we have an economy in which we produce people like, I would call them economic freaks, like Bill Gates, wonderful man, but an economic freak. How in the world does anyone get $20 billion? You know, but when they get the money, they're going to do something with it. They're going to express their concept of what a ideal society should be like, or a particular issue. What can we do about it? They have a greater ability to influence these things than you and I probably do. You're not a billionaire, are you? I haven't gotten there myself either. So I don't know what to say except that that's just another form of expression of their views. Does it work? No, it doesn't work. There's no real correlation between super rich candidates, Meg Whitman, Carly Fiorina. She couldn't buy the election. She tried like hell, but she couldn't buy it. So I don't think we have to fear. The reason I like money in politics is because it's the way that we all can organize ourselves and do something about an issue that we care about. So I think it's a good thing. Does that halfway answer your question?
So as a follow-up on that, Henry, you know, you're talking about, you know, not buying the election, but just expressing their viewpoints. I mean, I remember as a young man, thinking about John Conley when he ran. I mean, he had become famous for having been shot when he was governor of Texas with Kennedy. And he ran for president. Don't remember which year it was. But he spent a lot of money because he was a rich Texan. And he never got past 1% in the primaries for the vote. I mean, Meg Whitman, Carly, they did much better than that. But he spent a tremendous amount more than anybody else did at the time and still couldn't budge past 1%.
Yeah, I agree. I covered his campaign, and I agree. The most recent election we had, what was the influence of money in electing Obama versus Romney. They spent about the same amount of money, and their interest groups and their billionaires pretty much canceled one another out. My own estimation is as a former White House correspondent, Obama ran a smarter campaign. He ran a smarter campaign. He took Romney and made him the issue. He's a fat cat who doesn't care about regular people, was the line. Whether it's true or not is open for discussion. But instead of, I haven't really been able to do much as president, you know, which is what Romney's argument was. But I found it interesting and very enlightening that everybody in America who could read and write had both arguments, you know, pounded into them so many times that we really had all the information we needed to make a decision based upon our own interests.
If I may, I'd take a little, I won't say issue with, I'd like you to comment on. I think your comments are more on, as I perceive them, on a steady, steady line of a democratic institution. However, what we've had in this country, though, is a 30-year creep of control by extreme wealth. And as we let that extreme wealth increase, we, as a middle class or a population, lose our ability to object to that or to actually reverse that, because all of the power then has escaped us.
I completely disagree, hence yesterday's results. Obama wins with the support of labor unions. Now, labor unions raise money. Now, labor unions are a fantastic organization in terms of their ability to express their view. The labor unions in California, for example, 2.5 million people are in labor unions in California out of a workforce of about 18 million. And yet, because they raise money and fight against, you know, fat cats, quote unquote, they win all the time. In fact, they just elected a legislature in Sacramento that is completely veto-proof from any Republican governor and does not require any popular decision whatsoever to raise taxes. They have what's called a supermajority. Who do these people come from? They're little people, quote unquote. They're labor unions. They're workers. So, no, I have to disagree with you.
A follow-up, and I'm going to do it from a different point of view with a different example altogether to talk about politics and money. When the United States was the world's greatest creditor, where we were not a debtor to any country and that we were owed money by other countries, I think you have to go back into the 70s for that, we had more, it would seem that we had more influence in politics, or you could make your decisions differently. I'll give an example of Taiwan. Now that, you know, we've always been saying that Taiwan, you know, should be protected by us and so on. And it seems to me that we don't really aren't in a position to make that argument anymore. That no matter what happens, the fact that we owe China several $1 trillion or $1 trillion or whatever will make that decision impossible to make as a political decision. And so in that sense, I would think that the way that money runs has got to influence the way decisions are made. So I picked an example outside of the sphere of domestic politics altogether to ask you whether you don't think that the money has any influence over those decisions at all.
You know, you've taken me sort of beyond my pay grade here. I mean, I did cover international trade for 3 years, and I know that when your uncle has loaned you money, you're probably going to listen to everything he has to say and go to his house and eat dinner whenever he wants you to come to his house and eat dinner. I get that. But you also have control over your uncle because you owe him $5,000. You can pay him or not.
So it depends on how important the $5,000 is to your uncle.
In China, we are so inextricably involved with China, and we have some Chinese clients, Chinese company clients. We're so involved with them that it's really difficult to talk about us versus China. Our economies are inextricably bound up, and they're not bad guys anymore.
No, well, I agree with that. My point isn't that they're bad guys or that we should disagree with them. And in fact, Taiwan's government is fairly similar to their government. The differences are not that huge anymore after the last 30 years of change. So we might have changed our policy anyway. But it just seems to me that in a relationship, I had a speaker in last year talking about marriages, that when the wife starts to make more money than the husband, it changes the politics of the marriage in terms of who makes what decisions and so on. So it would seem to me that certainly would carry over into politics, that in spite of the fact that it's even a partnership between U.S. and China, that who has the money, who gives the money. I mean, it's the golden rule.
I see
rule,
where you're going.
Yeah.
I will jump in on this point because I found this to be fascinating. When I covered Congress and my wife Ellen was a aide in the U.S. Senate, and that's where I met her, in fact, when I was covering her boss, who was chairman of the Senate Banking Committee. But I don't think she would violently disagree with me if I said that members of Congress are going to more likely sit down with large campaign contributors than they are with people who are just really nice and smart, because that's what you see. If you want FaceTime with a senator, or a congressman, you're probably going to be, someone's going to check the record. Are you a supporter of the congressman? Are you a supporter of the senator? They know these things. They have all, even back when we were there, they had all the records. So, yeah. If I give a member of Congress through myself and family and friends $100,000, I can pretty much get him to roll over and jump like a dog. If I don't, I may not get even to see Ellen. I may have to see somebody in the district office. So, yeah, it has a lot of influence. But you can have influence. This is the positive side. If you want to organize because you care about a certain bird or a dam project or whatever, and I do mean a water project, you can raise the money. You can go out amongst your friends. You can raise money. You can make noise. And you can register your opinions. So that's why I do think, I hear all these people talking about how horrible money is in politics. I don't know what the hell we would do if we were not able to express ourselves that way. Yes, sir.
Okay, then what's your opinion about Citizens United?
I mean, it's the same opinion. I really don't have a moral or ethical comment on that at all. I mean, you should be able to raise money and express yourself on any point of view in our democracy. That I like. Yes, sir.
Yeah. A few years ago, the Supreme Court passed some different laws that allowed some of these super PACs to donate extreme amounts of money. And as that came through the courts, I was a little worried myself that money would be a huge influence now. Where do you think de Tocqueville or Machiavelli stands with the Supreme Court ruling?
They love it. There should be no inhibitions. It's a form of free speech. I mean, you can argue it the other way, but it's like you're a little bit pregnant or you're not. You're either going to have free speech or you're not going to have it.
Does the Supreme Court do you think that they're seeing the future? So you talk about the 30-year, if we're in the 30-year decline or if we're on the precipice of disaster, do you think the Supreme Court has helped us?
No offense to George, but do you think lawyers can see 30 years into the future?
Well, this is the Supreme Court.
Well, big lawyers, smart lawyers, political lawyers.
Next question. Anybody? Great.
George is beyond a lawyer. He's a philosopher now.
The Citizens United, what do you think about the secrecy of the people who are donating money, or do you think they should have to be revealed?
That's a really good question. Really good question, because transparency is absolutely essential in democracy. We have to know who these people are. And we've seen a lot of money laundering come into California on these propositions. And, you know, this is wrong. I don't like it. As a former reporter, I want to know what's going on. And so should each of you. So, no, there has to be an aggressive. And I, when I was first a reporter, politicians could hide anything and everything. On the state level, in the deep South, very corrupt, extremely corrupt. You couldn't figure out who was doing what to whom. unless you dug and dug and dug and got people drunk and got them to tell you stuff in the dead of night. There was no record-keeping government. There was no sunshine laws. We call them sunshine laws. They just got started in the 70s. And now they've become more and more abundant, and I think it's absolutely essential. You should be able to raise and spend any amount. People should know who you are and what you're doing. Thank you for that question.
Next question.
Oh, no, he can't ask a question. He's a reporter.
Here in California, the propositions that proliferate on the ballot, what's your opinion about that? Is that a good thing, or is it taking away responsibility that the legislature should hold and the legislature should be responsible for?
That's a perfect question, because we got this country started. We didn't want no founding father. They would have been horrified if you told them, we want the people to decide everything. Because I got to tell you something. I know a lot about government. I study a lot of things. I know about 1% of the things going on. And if you ask my opinion about the other 99%, I'm going to make the wrong decision. Because we're supposed to have here is a representative government. That's what the founding fathers wanted. You elect these people that you think are smart enough and spend the time to go up and study these things. You approve their general ideas about things. And then you go and let them make the decisions. Well, we got away from that a long time ago, California. Now everything is put on the people. But since the people are ignorant and easily persuaded to go one way or the other with lies, if you watch the commercials that were going on in California about these propositions, people were lying through their teeth. They were raising all kinds of crazy stuff, and no one was keeping score. I mean, there was one proposition that said that if you vote for this, you're back in Karl Rove. Karl Rove is going to benefit from this. The oil companies are going to benefit from this. It was totally blatant lies, but guess what? It was successful. So do I think the people, quote unquote, should make all these complex decisions? Absolutely not. I think that propositions in this state have run amok, and that we should be holding our representatives responsible. But guess what? They don't want to be responsible, because it's unpopular to vote on things for which you're going to be held accountable 2 to 4 years later.
If I'm guessing correctly by my memory, about half of you were at the lecture last month by Professor Patrick Iber, and he talked about the system in Mexico versus in the United States. One of the things he mentioned surprised everybody, which was that in Mexico for the presidential elections, they have a committee that looks over the ads before the ads are put out, and if they're not accurate, they're not allowed to use the ads. And everyone's saying, in Mexico? No. On the other hand, he also pointed out that because they have public funding of the elections, that there is an organization which is actually a front for drug dealers, and they want to always win at least 3% of the vote so that they can qualify for public funding, because that way they can get the public funds. And so they always hire some very popular movie star or something like that who then always gets elected. In the last election, he came in second. It wasn't a serious campaign. They just wanted the money. And so his point was, you know, you, it looks one way, it looks another way, and so on. Almost any method that you use, Machiavellian thought can get around it in order to try to, and using Machiavellian in the pejorative sense there. But it's great that you can point out that Machiavelli was a humanist, actually, just in this case a tortured one, that stated accurately what the prince was going to do anyway. So there's time for several more questions. Who else would like to ask a question? Anybody want to talk about the election, what how they reacted to the election? There's not a lot of anger in this room because it's San Francisco, so it's not really a big problem, but I would like to hear a little bit about it.
Yeah, I'd just like to know what you feel about the how we have an accumulation of wealth with a smaller group of people. That means there's money that a whole lot of other people will not have, and no one really talked about poor people. And we seem to have a large and larger proportion of the population that are classified as poor. And if we look around the world, we can see how that really affects the economy and also a nation. Hopefully you might want to talk about that a little.
Well, it's an awfully good question. Who represents poor people? And it would appear that Democrats represent poor people because they organize people who are on welfare. They organize them to vote, and we know that. They go out and knock on the doors, and they get in the buses, and they go and vote where they're supposed to. And then they get a small amount of money, food stamps and all kinds of other money like that, and it's just enough to subsist. So Democrats would appear to be the voice of poor people, and almost no one would argue with that, except for me. I would argue that a prosperous economy, one led by free enterprise, is going to lift all boats. Now, I know that was an argument that Reagan made. I was in Washington during the Reagan years, and I know he's not all that popular around here among people in San Francisco, but we saw the boats rising. We saw all the boats rising when the economy was rising. The opposite argument is also true, that when business is doing poorly and cannot hire, we do not have revenues to support programs for poor people. And the only way we can do it is to borrow money from other nations, which is a very limited point, as de Tocqueville pointed out. We cannot do that very long. We've been doing it now for the last two administrations, George Bush and President Obama. We've been borrowing money to give to poor people. It is not as good a plan, in my estimation, is trying to generate enough growth in the economy so that we can all work and have what I call sustainable jobs, which are not government jobs. Sustainable jobs are jobs in the private sector that don't require us to go out and borrow money to create, you know, the shovel-ready jobs. That's my own point of view because I'm a business person in business. I think that, and I have people in my family who would be classified as poor. And what I want them for them is not to have a little bit of money given to them by the government. I want them to be lifted up and given educational programs so that they can go and participate in the American economic experience. That's my own point of view.
There's, if you go back 50 years, the argument was more clear. But it's very interesting now that Communist China and India next to it have created this huge middle class. But not, you know, one is a kind of very difficult form of democracy, India, and the other is a dictatorship that runs the whole country, like a business. So as if there's a board of directors for the company and they shuffle everybody around, those of you who are not familiar, even though it's called a communist country, I mean, the Politburo moves their top executives around from one department to another as if the whole thing were the departments of one major corporation, and they have been very effective in making that work to a certain extent in terms of that. So it's not so perfectly clear one way or the other, but I think it's kind of obvious that certain principles that you're talking about are the ones that are being half adopted by other places and therefore making a difference. At least freedom is freedom to make your financial decisions, if not your political decisions.
Oh, I'd like
seems
to add.
Seems to eat that up. Yeah.
I'd like to add a point because I also covered things in throughout the world. I remember being in Egypt once, and in the heartland, and watching these army trucks come along with giant sacks of grain. And they would stop in these villages, and they would kick the grain off the back of the truck, and the villagers would run up and grab the grain and then take it in their little, they had little bowls and things, and they would get a certain amount of grain, and they would go back to the village. So I was asking the government official that I was traveling with, what's going on here? He said, well, we give them enough food to keep them quiet. And to me, that was Egypt has been running like a kind of a dictatorship for a long time. It's not a free enterprise system. And that emblematically to me meant, what if we just brought in enough jobs so these villagers wouldn't just have enough to fill their bellies, but could actually, you know, work in manufacturing or some other area and raise themselves up? So that's my own personal take on the question.
Yeah, George touched on the solution in Mexico about ensuring that the ads were truthful. I wonder if you have any ideas about what we could do in the United States to police the ads that are, you know, filled with untruths?
It's a really tough question because it interferes to accomplish the very good thing that you're suggesting, engages our freedom of press and freedom of speech guarantees. So we actually have the freedom to lie, as we heard throughout the campaign, both sides. We had these fact checkers the next day, right? They both talk, and then the next day, Obama told five lies, Romney told five lies, here are the lies. Thinking, this is really complex. You got to listen to the speech, and then you got to go and figure out who was lying in a way that more offends you than another guy. How to do what you're suggesting? As I say, it's beyond my pay grade.
I agree totally. It's a very interesting question to answer. But I'm interested, since your experiences over the last 30, 40 years, it seemed to me that newspapers and the media before had this editorial, you know, policy, and that maybe the lack of finances in the media industry has influenced this, because they're probably their biggest earner are these elections, because they get a lot of that money.
Maybe
the shift in media has influenced their editorial policy, because they used to say, we're not going to run that, or we're not going to run that ad, that kind of stuff.
Well, media, you're talking about broadcast.
Right, in this case.
And I was a newspaper man, I think that I would like to answer it as a former newspaper man, because as we all know, newspapers have declined. They have very little money to operate. Thank God I worked in newspapers in the golden age. We had money, we had tons of money. I could get on a plane and go to France to research and come back. Nothing. No one would say anything. Now they don't have enough money for a cab ride across town and back. They have to do everything from the desk. So the lack of resources in the most sensitive area, political reporting used to be the province of daily newspapers and weekly magazines. Those were the people that did the most objective. I used to have editors. I had this editor in Atlanta. He was like a gargoyle. He was like a troll who lived under the bridge, waiting for you to come up with a piece of copy that couldn't be totally defended, every fact, every number. And he would humiliate you and scream out, reading fun in an amusing way about how stupidly you had not properly defended your article. Those are the kind of editors that protected American democracy. Because here is a guy who's a sloppy reporter, he didn't get it quite right, the editor's humiliating him, he's not going to do it again. We don't have them anymore. We don't have the teams covering things that we used to. And I was talking earlier with Chris Rauber, who's a reporter for the San Francisco Business Times, about how in the 19th century all of our newspapers were partisan. They call them, you know, the Democrat, the Republican, they were the Federalist, you know, they were all partisan. We didn't have objective reporting. We had objective reporting throughout most of the 20th century, and it was our line of defense against BS. And now we kind of have it. The fact checkers are helpful to us. Did y'all all read fact checkers after speeches? Did you follow that a little bit? Wasn't it astonishing what people would get away with? I mean, the President of the United States, the head of the Republican Party, standing up there and telling bald-faced lies just to gain advantage. And then we would have to go back the next day, and guess what? I read, and it's probably true, that the fact-checkers were biased. So not only did we have the guys telling us fairy stories, the fact-checkers were influenced by one side or the other, and they were either reporting on one guy's facts or the other guy's facts correctly. So how do you decide? Consistency. Over a period of time, you get to the point where you figure out what the guy's really for, and then you can make your decision.
I've always thought the greatest value proposition for the Internet, which has not been tapped by anybody, would be to create an editorial confidence like that some of the top newspapers had before, that then all the people who are trying to make their way through could say, this has been checked by this editorial policy, which is trying to be as objective as possible and gets the reputation. But that takes decades to get that reputation, no, by access. Time for one last question. Who would like to ask it? Anybody else?
Great. I wanted to get back to the grain in Egypt. I was thinking of candidate Romney's comments. He'd like to run the government like a business. Isn't that what he would say? So, wouldn't that part of that be creating jobs or creating an avenue for jobs? And what is the downside to the government getting involved in sustainable jobs?
Well, you can ask Obama, because he actually did get us very involved in green energy. Solyndra is an example, and it worked out. It had a horrible outcome. The taxpayer was on the hook for hundreds of millions of dollars because Obama decided, I happen to agree with him, that we should be stimulating green energy. But he had people working with him in the White House who didn't understand business any more than they understood ballet. And they screwed it all up. And we wasted tons of taxpayers' dollars trying to create Solyndra-type energy. So the question is a good question. Should government be involved in the economy? And the answer is absolutely. And we have been since George Washington. George Washington went out into Congress and got money to build the CNO Canal, linking Washington with the Chesapeake, linking the Chesapeake Bay and the Ohio River so that we could have commerce linking the two areas going back as far as Washington. So Romney was, in my estimation, Romney, again, being a centrist, Romney was wrong about over-accentuating the role of business in government. You can't run government like a business. I know exactly how government works. I mean, I looked at people running governments for 15 years every day, in and out of all the offices. You can't run it like a for-profit business. So Romney's wrong about that. His statement was that he knew how to influence the process of creating new companies in the private sector and removing obstructions to that and over-regulations and stimulating it in a way that the private sector could operate better by itself. In other words, not taxing them so heavily and removing unnecessary regulations. But to have a guy to say, I'm a great businessman, I'll be a great president, that was BS from day one, because it's really different kinds of organizations that run. I know about both organizations, and you can't run the government like a business because citizens are not employees and they're not consumers. It's a whole different paradigm. One would hope that Obama has learned enough about the private sector, and his statements have been, and he praised the business sector as the greatest creation in America. We hope that now he has learned more about that and will be more helpful to business in creating jobs. But no, I don't agree with Romney's position on that.
I think that's a great way to end, and it's fascinating, of course, that the election, you know, finished early this morning, and within a couple of hours, people were talking, both parties were talking about, well, now we have to deal with this problem, the fiscal cliff and immigration reform, all these things that we had never heard anything about throughout the entire campaign, which, you know, now they're going to get down to the substance. And I thought, well, you know, the campaign is over. They actually do turn back to substance, at least they're forced to in the case of the fiscal cliff. But it's a fascinating part of what you talked about was this is a game, this is the way the process is played. And that was a campaign, and now they're going to have to govern. It would be great if somebody could sort out which paradigms, which institutions the government paradigm works the best for, and which ones the private sector works the best for, and which ones charitable organizations work the best for, and then everybody with the different kinds of personalities fit in those thoughts. But, of course, we can't do that by dictatorship because it wouldn't work. So thank you very much, Henry. That was just great.
Thank you.
And so ends another enlightened discussion at the Commonwealth Club in its 110th year of enlightened discussion.